For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Two public service announcements for this evening. Number one, tonight's class has been sponsored by my parents and my aunt in memory of my mother's mother, Shendel Bas Shmuel, Mrs. Shirley Streifler, who is tonight is Wednesday night. Tuesday night, Wednesday will be her 5th yard site. I was very privileged to grow up with three grandparents until I was in my mid-30s. Which is quite a privilege that I am aware of. My grandmother, whose yard site is this week, actually lived in my parents' house for the last 9 years of her life. She was born in Poland and got out of the war as a little girl of 14 or 15. She taught herself to sew and with a trade managed to get to Switzerland. And the rest of her family perished in the Holocaust. I don't want to take much of your time. She actually got paper. She got money and papers to send back she was the youngest in the family, for her next youngest sibling, who was like 17 or 18. All of her other siblings were already married. And the last letter that she received from her family was from this youngest sibling saying, "You abandoned the family. What should I do with mom and dad?" And so she wouldn't leave. And then they all tragically perished. And she would cry telling that story till her dying day. It stayed with her forever that she went through all that effort to get them out, and you can't put anyone in with it. Anyway, she was a Polish woman, and she used to save tinfoil and paper plates, and I had all that stuff was older than me. Every single thing in her house, everything from the toilet paper to the paper towel, everything in the house was older than I was, and that had a tremendous impact on me. And this is her 5th website, and so we're sponsoring in her memory. If any of you would also like to sponsor subsequent weeks, please see me. We'd love to be able to do so. Offer a Nash opportunity to make brachas for everybody here. Public service announcement number two. Very honored to have Rabbi Osher Yablok of the AJA Upper School, formerly known as YA, present tonight. We've had Rabbi Yablok in many of our previous courses. And like always, he has brought his technology with him, and you will have the slides up on the board. We are printing out hard copies as well. The hard copies are not yet ready. Gail Vexler is hard at work running them off. They will be here shortly, and as they are ready, we will bring them out, and you will actually have hard copies of the sheets that Rabbi Yablok will be using in front of you as well. So without any further ado, I believe that is it. Rabbi Yablok.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Freund, Lech Yasher Koach. I very much look forward to this opportunity, and I really do thank you. It's a little bit intimidating. Maybe it's a lot of it intimidating. I spend time with students in school, and I spend time learning with them. But this group is definitely a very special group for me to see the time you take out and the crowd that comes together to review, in this case, the very essentials of Judaism. Really what we're all about. And I would say day to day I walk into the classroom confident, but I always walk in front of an esteemed crowd like this quite nervous. And I look forward to the chance to learn together. So please calm me down, share your thoughts and ideas, and let's learn together about some very important information. It works out well that I'm nervous because we're talking about divine providence, Hashgach HaPratis, so whatever God has in store for us tonight will just be what He has in store for us tonight. Like Rabbi Feuerlech mentioned, I like to use things like this to get to know a little bit about you and for every one of you to get to know about each other. So I pose a simple question for you, although your answering to it might be a little bit more complicated. My question is, how involved, in your mind, is Hashem, our God, in our day-to-day life? How much is He controlling? I stubbed my toe today. Was that something that He ordained for me? I didn't get a job. I did get the job. Somebody ordered the last donut before I got there. How involved is God in our life? How much is He defining for us as we go through our day to day? And I'm eager for you to hear what other people sitting next to you think, if they haven't whispered to you already. So the way to do this is by text message, unless you're on a computer. If you have a phone, you can text it in. If you don't, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand and share your thoughts. But while we're doing it, you can text in your answer. The way to do it is text it to Usher Yablok 544. That should be the recipient of your text message. And I'm sorry, the recipient should be 37607. The text of your message should be Usher Yablok 544. That's me. I don't know what 544 stands for. And then you're going to text your answer in. So far, somebody thinks God is 100% involved in our lives. I was wondering if it would be. Someone's really good. So once again, the recipient of your text message will be 37607. The text of your message will be Usher Yablok 544, and then the letter that you choose to vote for. Let's see what we each think about this topic.
We already know the answer.
Yeah. That's right. For the non-cell phone users, who wants to start us off? What do you think of the choices? Yeah. You think A. All right. Anybody have anything besides an A as their answer? We've got two A's so far. Yes. I don't know. Okay, fantastic. I should have given you an I don't know a choice. And please, I think the goal of this class, as much as we will aim to learn about this topic, there is an important takeaway. What we think about this issue may or may not change what it is, right? If I tell you tonight that the answer is C, whether or not I'm right, God is already doing whatever God does. We're not going to change that. But what we learn tonight is going to make a difference about how we live our lives. Because the way we react to our lives, the way we behave, and the way we conduct ourselves when we have adversity, when we have our dreams. Just today, two seniors in my school walked over to me after Shacharis, after we were davening, and said, "Rabbi, today we're finding out from University of Maryland whether we got in. It's our number one choice. What tefillah should we say, you know, to beseech God on our behalf?" And I said, "We just daven mincha. You should have told me beforehand. I would have told you exactly what tefillah to say." But then I said, "Is the letter already in the mail?" And they said, "Oh yeah, probably. They already decided." So I'm like, "So what's the discussion here?" But these are decisions that you're making every day. Your life goes one way or the other. You have certain desires, certain wants. And we react to our lives and we relate to God based on how we think it works. So I was surprised to see, I see now four B's. Any B's want to raise their hand, share their thought on this? Yeah, what are you willing to share?
On one hand, I can say, you know, A, that God loves everything, but it seems to me that there are things that God doesn't care who wants to preserve in our life. And there are other things that are kind of like to me about how I do things and having some free will to do things. So, is he involved? Well, God's there. Is he calling all the shots and you know, doing every test piece?
Not prepared to say.
I'm not prepared to say. Yeah. I mean, I'm an open book on it, but I'm,
okay.
You know, it doesn't feel like everything should be.
Sure. Well, I'm a super huge Seahawks fan, and I'm willing to admit it this year because it's a good year to admit that. And I always am fascinated when the athletes score a touchdown or win a game and praise God and kneel down to God. And, you know, we always in yeshiva used to say, is God really sitting there worrying about who's going to win the Super Bowl this year? He's got important things to worry about. And that's kind of the argument you're making. He's no doubt he's involved in our life. He's got important things going on. And perhaps the outcome of a particular game, and that's kind of big, but even lesser things than that, the growth of a particular plant, might be left to some course of nature. Yeah?
If I miss getting into an accident or chas v'shalom get into an accident, I tend to blame or thank Hashem.
That's right.
You know, but if I picked up the wrong sock or if I strengthened something real minor,
right?
I don't think Hashem needs to get involved, I guess, my feeling.
I understand completely. Yeah.
Although, you know, you talked about stubbing your toe, but what if stubbing your toe prevented you from catching an airplane that then
sure.
crashed?
Sure.
So you might think that he's not in charge of stubbing your toe.
Yeah.
He doesn't really care.
That's right.
Except in that case, he did.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm responsible for teaching 10, 20 young men and women every day. teaching Torah, I think, is important to God. The next generation of kids, I think, is important. If I can't make it, not that I'm such a big deal, but if I can't make it, I think people's lives are impacted in a big way, because I think 20 people studying Torah is a big deal. So there's no question that things are related, things are connected. I happen to have a brother-in-law who was sick on 9/11, and he didn't go, and that was it. We know people like that. It happens. Every year he sends me the stub of the gift shop, or the shop where he picked up his orange juice before he walked in. It doesn't exist. Then that day he didn't happen to go there. There's no question that those decisions they impact every step of our lives. All right, any C's, D's, and E's? I'm assuming not, unless those are the technologically disadvantaged. All right. So there's really two parts to this discussion. One part is how it works. What is God's role? What does our literature tell us about what God's role is in this world, his supervision? And part two is our reaction to it. I'm supremely more concerned with our reaction because we don't really change what God does in this world. We change what we do. Maybe perhaps we can influence them one way or the other, but ultimately we don't change those parameters. But I feel responsible for us because those are the pressing questions. Pressing questions are, how much is God involved in supervising this world? I want to get some of the key sources about the nature of his supervision. And then we'll talk about how that leads us to, how that influences our behavior, how that leads us to behave. We had a similar discussion in school this past week about free will. Some of the kids said to me, "Rabbi, who cares about free will? Either it is or it isn't. What does it matter whether we agree or disagree?" And I showed them, the research shows that it matters a lot. If you think you're accountable and you're in charge of your decision, the research shows you're going to behave differently. They did a test. They had this group watched a 45-minute video of PhDs all saying that man has no free will. This group sat in the other room and watched the Sesame Street. Then they both took a test in which cheating was an option. It was available. And that group cheated a lot more. They're not really responsible for their actions. You can play around with the research, quote a different study. The point is that what we learn about this information is, and what we want to walk away with from tonight, is how this influences our behavior. What are we going to do? How are we going to react when knowing what we know and learning what we do? And that's my goal for us tonight. If they ask you, what did Yablok teach you? I guess they have it on record, so they'll be able to look it up. But if they ask, what did Yablok talk about? The point is, how do we behave? But how does this information influence our lives? That's what we want to come away with. Any questions so far? Yes?
I usually took a walk on Friday night, like 8 o'clock or so, and I didn't take a walk that Friday night.
Right.
And then they said I shot in Chicago and then killed a guy in Evanston where I would have walked roughly.
Right.
And you know, I really did believe 100% that Hashem is the one who had shot that night. And therefore, you know, I was very thankful to him. I didn't thank you, Gomel, or anything. But,
right.
You know, there was a feeling of thank you, Hashem, for whatever, you know, I did instead of walking that night at that specific time.
For sure. I think many of us would react that way. I think that's the right way to react. That's the way our parents taught us. Yes, the observation was that in his particular life, and I'm going to generalize, we all have a similar experience where something perhaps negative was going to happen and happened on the spot where you were supposed to be, and for whatever circumstances you were guided not to be there. The visceral reaction, I think, of many in the room would be to thank God that we avoided the negative, or to wonder with God why, if it actually occurred to us, why he ordained it to be. As opposed to saying, that's nature, that's life, it happens. And so that seems to be one way to answer some of these questions that we're going to raise. How do you react? Well, many people tend to react by associating it with God. I think it's the right way to do it. So let's learn a little bit about how divine providence works. That's the fancy English word for hashkacha pratit, which is our topic for tonight, which is individual supervision. This source, I believe, exists in the packet that you'll have access to, the things I'm going to be putting on the screen. So there are hard copies coming around, and they're going to have anything you see on the screen will be in there. So you don't have to look up here if you're not a visual person. That's fine. You can look straight in front of you. These are some very important questions, and they're, I think the answer to our poll question is built into here. What does it mean? Does God really care about every single detail? Yes. Excellent. Here's a question for the room. What did I mean when I wrote involved? What do we mean when we talk about God involved in our lives? And my response, naturally, because I'm a teacher, formerly a lifeguard, is going to be along those lines. When I sit in a classroom or supervise a swimming environment, I'm either actively involved, I'm instructing, and I'm calling the shots, you sit here, you learn this material. Sometimes I'm supervising learning, and perhaps the student don't realize, but I'm making sure the right person's sitting with the right person and refocusing this group and kind of just managing it so the outcome is the way I want, but I'm not actively telling them what to say, how to say it, as opposed to when I'm teaching. And sometimes I'm sitting back and saying, the rules of the classroom are in place, learning is taking place, you know, I'm going to sit back and watch. So you're right, the question that we're talking about when we stay involved, there's degrees. And what we're trying to balance is, what is the degree, the maximum degree of supervision or involvement, which we're going to say is, we said 100%, meaning God deciding that I'm going to move to Atlanta, that I'm going to teach in this school, that I'm going to have this many kids, I'm going to name them that, etc. Versus, perhaps there is the maximum amount of hashgacha, of involvement, but only towards certain people, or certain beings, or on certain levels. We can mix and match any way we want. We're going to try to come up with a whole. But I think your question really cuts the core of the class. What is the nature of God's divine providence? How does what type of management style does he have? I guess is what we're trying to achieve. So hopefully I'll have answered the question to your question as we see through these sources. I once had a boss who was do they call it type A? I don't know, type A or something. Yeah. Anytime it didn't appear like I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, he gave me a new assignment. So I mentioned I was a lifeguard and it was raining. So what do lifeguards in camp do? It's their favorite day of the week when it rains. You just sit back and wait for the rain to stop. You always had to find, so there's those type of management styles, and there's a management style that says, I've trained you, you've learned things well, now I want to see how you behave and how you handle it. Rabbi Arye Kaplan approached this topic the same way. He imagined God as a person who had just discovered an island and had a message for that island about how he wanted them to behave. Maybe he wanted to introduce democracy, morals, ethics, whatever it is he wanted to introduce. And he wrote this in a book, If You Were God, and you might have seen it on the shelf. And he said, you can do anything, but your final goal is that these people realize these standards, whether it's democracy, whether it's belief in the divine, without your challenges that you can't reveal yourself to them. Like God himself limits in itself in a certain way. How do you go about getting that message across? In other words, part of this discussion is that God, at its core, wants us to achieve a certain goal. And like some of my students say, he just won't come out and say it to me. If he would just appear and say, hi, I'm God, and like the old routine, I'm God, and this is what I expect of you. My students say, of course we believe. Of course we do anything that he said. It's that he's not revealed and that he's kind of removed a little bit that makes it harder. The topic for tonight of divine providence is that middle ground where our belief and our understanding that God is involved in our lives and he's there and he's playing a role, but it's not the overt way in the same way that you'd have a teacher or a parent in the room with you. So let's gather some data, let's look at some sources, and see if we can arrive at some clarity about this I think, a quite pressing issue. The first source we're going to look at is on your packet. All right, so take a peek at source number 2 in the first section, the one from Rabbi Chaim Friedlander. Has that name come up in this course before? Rabbi Chaim Friedlander was the spiritual supervisor of a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael called the Panovich Yeshiva. It obviously is from the town called Panovich, but it moved to Israel. And he authored a number of important works on Jewish fundamentals. That's what I imagine he might have come up, because he articulated for the modern Israeli community a lot of key Jewish fundamentals about our belief and our relationship with God. And he says there are two parts to supervision. There's knowing what's going on, and is deciding what to do about it. And there were philosophers throughout history who took different positions on this. God doesn't know what's necessarily going on. He created the world and let it go. Or God knows every detail about what's going on. And what he says of the Jewish belief is that both are in play. God is aware of every detail of our life, and he responds accordingly. Which in some ways answers our question completely. But I guess he knows who wins the Super Bowl. He knows all the details. How much that takes up in his concept of awareness, I don't know. But he's aware of all the details of our lives, you see? And he decides how to respond and what to do based on what's going on. To me, this is already the first hint of the role that we played and our takeaway from this. But that's the Jewish concept.
If there would be a weaker team and a better team, could you
have Yeah. Well, so I think this is still apropos for this, the Torah portions that we're reading. The question was, if there would be a weaker team and a stronger team, could he influence the weaker team to win? And we won on Hanukkah with the weaker team against the stronger team. Some might argue that was a Jewish people, that was the achieving his goals in the world. But I assume, yeah, he could.
Six-day war,
for sure. There's no question about it. I think what this discussion is going to come down to is when. That he has that that he knows what's going on, and that he responds accordingly, there's no question. But you all know sometimes the teacher knows what's going on and they don't necessarily respond. Right? I know that the kids are copying from each other, and I respond afterwards individually as opposed to stopping it in a public forum. Sometimes you know what's going on with your kids in the room, and you don't. Your no response is your response. The question is when God's going to influence the outcome, I think, is one that's going to be the most pressing for tonight. But this is already our base level understanding. You see in the top right corner the Hebrew term hashkacha, and he says the concept of God's supervision or providence is defined by those two shnei chalakim, those two features. And they're both in play. Scroll down a little bit to number 3. Some have argued that this is critical to our belief. The defining features of an observant Jew, some would say, are the Rambam's principles. And he says one of those principles is that you believe in reward and punishment. God knows what you do, and he reacts accordingly. It's funny to me, because every time I sat down to think about this class, I kept getting mixed up between free will and divine providence. You understand why as you begin to think about these issues? If those players have free will, then they should define the outcome. If God is supervising 100%, which a number of the people in the room believe, then he decides the outcome. Where's the balance? And we know, as critical as God's supervision is to this world, we also believe that each person has free will. That's how you earn, so to speak, your reward versus perhaps earning your punishment. So there's an interplay there that's tough to figure out. And I like to shed some light on it, but if your mind keeps coming back and forth to that issue, it's because they're so closely related. I hold my children responsible when they make a mistake because I believe they have the ability to have made a better decision. What if one of my kids said to me, well, God's in charge? He made me do it. Yeah. He's divine, you know, there's complete, they vote letter A. There's divine hashkach, there's complete hashkach prati. God is walking me through this life. What do I say to them? So I can say no, not really. But if you answered 100%, what's your answer? Sure, absolutely. So let's get to the next step. General hashkacha, which is the broad concept that the management of the world, that the sun rises, the systems work properly, our systems work properly, and specific hashgacha, which means an individual species, an individual person, that God would show particular supervision over and work with. And both are at play. I think those of us certainly who voted 100% assumed he was doing all of these things. But you can imagine drawing a line and separating. And perhaps saying that the general supervision of this world, God left to nature. Which is, he set up certain rules, you throw something up, it's going to fall back down. And that's not him anymore. Those are the rules that he set in play, and he wills those rules to be in play, but they're in play. And then there's the specific, which is going to say that God's going to make sure that Pharaoh's heart is really stubborn, so that he can execute, no pun intended, he can execute his plan to get the Jews out of Mitzrayim. Specific versus general. Let's see what we have here. I spoke about Rav Moshe Chaim Lusato last year. Has he come up recently? We abbreviate him Ramchal. Came up last week. Excellent. He lived till he was 40. Had somewhat of a difficult life. He was recognized as a mystic and a successful one at a very young age. But it was in the years following Shabtai Tzvi. And for that reason, being a public mystic was not a good thing to do. And for that reason, many people pushed him. Ultimately, he became most famous for his works that were not mystical, but they were about faith and relationship with God. He's buried in Eretz Yisrael. I believe he's buried right next to the tomb of Rabbi Akiva, which is interesting, because when did Rabbi Akiva start studying Torah? He was 40. So some people think there's a mystical connection between the two. But he's a fascinating thinker. He was obviously, you could tell by his name, he was in Italy. So he writes, in source number one, God constantly supervises His entire creation, giving it existence and guiding it according to the purpose for which He created. Does that sound general or does that sound specific?
General.
Meaning He wants to achieve a goal, right? So whether I get a paper cut may or may not impact His goal. But He's seeing to it that His ultimate goal is followed through. But you could have taken that, I heard some people whispering or specific, you could have taken that he manages everything to achieve that goal. Not entirely clear. Let's see. This is a well-known source in rabbinic literature, but it's very influential in our discussion tonight. Number two, Ein lecha kol esav ve'esav she'ein lo mazal, barakia she'makeh oto ve'emer lo gadel. Every single blade of grass has a spiritual force appointing it, which says, grow. What do you learn from that midrash? What we're going to see is that different people interpreted these things differently. Is that spiritual force kind of like the force of nature that God set in play? And nature is the term we might use in our parlance. You might use mazal if you were centuries ago. And God's not, other than allowing those forces to exist, God's not waking up this morning, so to speak, and saying, grow. They grow because he told them once and they kept doing it. Versus him working on the nuclear deal with Iran, perhaps it's something that might take more of his interest. That's the debate. How literal are you going to even read some of these sources? But I agree. The general trajectory is that God is very, very, very aware, very, very, very involved. Let's see if it stays that way. But you're going to have people influenced by this discussion who might say no. Who might say, yeah, it's certainly willed by God, but it's kind of like an autopilot. And God leaves those things to the rules He set in place. That's a different type of supervision. And it reflects a very different understanding of how God works, versus saying that He is intimately involved in every step, every day, making it happen. And again, so then the prayers that we say, when we say, Mechadesh b'chol yom b'tuvo, that God constantly renews the world, can also be interpreted depending on your decision. You can say that means that he wills those systems and those concepts that he set in place to continue to be, or he literally goes through each item in each cell, and each smaller than a cell, and makes them anew on his own. We'll have to decide how it goes. And again, our takeaway has to be, how does this influence our decision? So the general type, though, is most, what I just pointed out, is most heavily expressed by the Rambam. Maimonides, the Mor Nevuchim. Have we seen that source before, the Mor Nevuchim? He had a student who reached out to him and said, I have some philosophical issues with, not concerns, but curiosities with Judaism. Can you help me? And he wrote that student a letter, which looked like a book. And in that book, he explained his take, some might say a more rational take, on how the world works and how God relates to the world. He called it the Moreh Nevuchim. We commonly translate that as the guide to the perplexed. Moreh, a teacher, an instructor, and Nevuchim, from the Parsha, where the Jews were Nevuchim Ba'aretz, they were Bamidbar, they were misguided in the desert. And he wrote about this topic as well. But look how he draws the line. He manages animals on a species-wide level. He's not worried this gazelle or that gazelle. He's worried that there are gazelles. Perhaps with some he decides they don't need to be anymore. They're gone. But it's a broader type of supervision, the way the Rambam describes it. Kind of like we'll see later, the Jewish people need to exist, that I'm going to be a part of it, not entirely clear. Depends on my life. So this is a more general definition. It's not as specific as we have been before. This is commonly attributed to the Rambam, that a lot of things are allowed to perpetuate based on God's general approach, but not as specific. Some have said, if you read that top paragraph, some have said that that's because animals have a different type of purpose in this world than humans do. That's certainly the Rambam style. We're going to skip down a little bit. If you'll notice, one of the questions on my poll was only for important things, and one of the options, or only for times where it affects others or the rest of the world. Now, it may be true that we're so interconnected that it's hard to differentiate. There was a TV series, a short-lived one. Is there anybody here who watched the TV series 24? Can I mention that, Ms. Jacob? Yeah, 24? So the star from 24 started another series, which I don't think was very popular, called Touch. I don't know if you noticed it. It's already not on TV anymore. And the premise of Touch was that everybody's lives are interconnected. And each episode was how it all came together. One of those classic shows where they didn't realize it, they walked by each other, and it all ties together. So you can argue that that's certainly true. But on the flip side, it could be that some parts of my life are not going to impact anybody else, or even myself, or my kids. We don't have to go into the gory details, but some parts of your life just relate to you. And if it's like that today, okay, you'll deal with it. Tomorrow will be different. It doesn't matter so much. And you could take the position that, like God does, and we'll see this, certainly when it comes to non-human entities, He only cares with them, so provided that it's going to impact the people that He created in this world. And that's the source from Radak. Are we familiar with the Radak? Rabbi David Kimchi, this is the person who lived in, I imagine, the 1200s. A Spanish person, primarily known for grammar and his commentary on Tanakh, on the entire thing, from the beginning of Chumash to the end of the last volume, all 24 books. He also wrote, via his commentary, he wrote on all things covered in the prophets and in the writings, and you see that he deals with this as well. But that's his theory. Individual providence extends to non-human entities only as they relate to people. We're scaling back some of God's business so that He can be focusing, not because He needs to, but because that's His desire, on people and on the goal that He's trying to realize in this world. The question is how that relates to us. I know I've been taking a long time to get there. How does that relate to us? Are we going to argue that nations get that treatment? Whole communities get the treatment of the generic treatment? Or once you get to people, and certainly the Jewish people, are we going to argue that that's off the table? So that's what we mean when we talk about a specific individual. Are there people who take up a particular place? We start with the Torah. This is in the prophet section from Yirmiyahu. You made the heavens and the earth with your great strength and your outstretched arm, and nothing can be hidden from you. That reiterates the concept of God's awareness of everything. Great in counsel, mighty in deeds, your eyes are open to all the ways of man, so you may give every person according to his, and I'm going to add, or her ways, and according to the consequences of his or her action. So when it comes to humankind, starting from the prophets, we're seeing God intimately involved. He reacts to us based on our decisions, each according to what we deserve. If I'm reading this carefully, the implication is that when I stubbed my toe, it was somehow coming to me. You give every person according to his or her ways and the consequences of their actions. You guys agree or disagree about my conclusion? Agree. Is there a possibility that you don't have to agree? Disagree. Again, it seems very 100%. But again, let's think critically. Maybe there's no... I wasn't deserving of a consequence. Maybe I stubbed my toe. I've got free will. It's of no relevance. And maybe I have sinned and I'm deserving of consequences, and that'll come a different way. My point is that each time you read these sources, I know it sounds like it's coming over and over again, but you've got to decide, how specific does it really mean? He gives me according to my consequences. That could mean on a general level in my life. That could mean I'll max out at this degree of success. Or that could be very specific. You've got to make a decision. Look at the sources.
That's deception, though, if you're looking at... But it's...
Well, I hear you completely. I would say 15 years ago, I would have responded to you by quoting a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. The Mishnah has, I believe it's Hillel, sitting by a riverbed, and he sees a skull floating through the river. And he says, he utters towards the skull, because you drowned someone else, you drowned. And as a result of that, the person who drowned you is going to get the same consequence. And I said, that's how we understood it. And it's hard. Then I looked at Rashi's commentary not long ago. Rashi's commentary says, we don't learn this Mishnah in our Beit Midrash because we don't agree. Which obviously means that there was a variant text. He wouldn't have just thrown out a Mishnah. Anybody who studies Rashi enough knows he's not just going to, I don't like that, rip it out. Besides the fact that something's printed on the back. You don't want to lose that. But I agree. You get stuck a little bit either way, though. And I want to balance it out.
I agree with that. I'm just saying.
Because my...
It's not me.
Yeah, I agree.
It does, you know, you've got
categories
and stuff.
Sure.
But I don't think...
That's fair. The flip side struggle, and I'm not saying you don't already know this. The flip side struggle is the haphazard interpretation of the world. Hurricane Katrina happens. It happens. It, without saying I've got to learn something, perhaps mankind has to learn something. And everything we know about our religious education and our experiences seems to be that we're supposed to learn. Not too long ago, I was a student of a fellow named Dr. Pelkovitz, who's wrote a number of books. He's just like. Psychologist or a psychiatrist, I forget, he's a professor, psychologist. And he told us, I was in his class, we met every Friday as part of our rabbinic training, and he said he was in the process of conducting research of what people like to hear when they're experiencing suffering. Nobody likes to hear anything when they're experiencing suffering, but he knows that people have certain responses. I'm going to visit the Shiva house, I'm either going to say this or that. And he was trying to figure out what people got more strength out of. So, what are the typical answers? Somebody experiences an unspeakable loss. What do you say to someone like that? You're a close friend. So most of us don't know what to say, which is why I'm sure they invented that the person has to speak to you first. But what can you say? What are some options?
He's in a better place.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you can't win, but that's what people say sometimes. That person's not suffering anymore. They're close to God. They're in a happy place. And what's the reaction of the person suffering? Doesn't make me feel any better. Okay, what else can you say? God's will. God knows you can. You're going to become stronger because of this. You can say that, right? But he doesn't test anybody who's not up to the test. What's the reaction to that? I'm not up to the test. I don't want to be stronger. I'm just the way I am. And he was trying to hash it out. It was a long-going research, and I graduated and moved on. But there's no question that the... You don't want to know the answer. Call him up. I have his cell phone now. I'll find out for you. I'll report to Rabbi Y. But my point is that you're right. The person who's sitting Shiva, again, that's a pretty dramatic explanation, but the person who's experienced the suffering probably has a less simple way of navigating through this. But I have to say that my impression from these sources, and you have them in front of you, and you continue to study them till the next class, is that we're supposed to. We're supposed to learn from the things that we experience. Our tradition is that God is aware, is reacting to a person based on their behavior. And that's for the good also, which we'll get to in a second, but it's sometimes for the bad. And all I recall is one of my rabbis, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, who was primarily in Chicago, but he traveled to New York once his older brother passed away to stay shiur in yeshiva, and he had a horrible stroke before I ever got to yeshiva. You remember seeing him in the hallways? And he had half of his body was relatively useless. I think he described it as like carrying around, he was one body carrying around another part of his body. But one time we listened closely because it sounded like he was talking while he was walking. We figured he was just learning. And occasionally he was saying, Baruch Stein Ha'emet, Baruch Stein Ha'emet. And he told us he was suffering. It was uncomfortable. And he was interpreting that suffering to be from God. And he was accepting God's judgment. That's what he was deciding for him. I wouldn't have told you this whole thing if it was about me. But I that happened to be 20 years ago, and I'm still thinking, bouncing it around my head, how he really reacted to God's actions, how he interpreted things he was experiencing. He could have taken the position that this happens. God set it up that sometimes people's bodies fail. Parts of their bodies fail. Happens to some, doesn't happen to others. He did not take that position, and I think the sources that we're seeing are kind of pushing us in that direction. Just because I mentioned stubbing my toe, I figured we had to look at source number two. Did you read it yet? So it's coming back on itself again. No person, according to Rabbi Hanina, stubs his toe. I'm interpreting. Bangs his finger without it being decreed from above. I'm assuming that's what Ravarn meant. When I feel the suffering, I feel today different from yesterday or the same from yesterday, God has a message for me. And we're learning something from it. The Ramchal comes back again telling us how we're distinguished from animals in that sense. But here's take home number one. I told you we wanted to focus on our behavior. Take home number one from this whole discussion is that it's still midah keneged midah. Who knows what that means? Measure for measure. We know that well. And the takeaway that I think we need to have from this conversation, and we can read volumes and volumes about God's role in this world, is how it influences our behavior. What are we going to do? Including, and again, I'm only being so bold as to say from the sources, but including people who suffer a lot. Or including trying to learn something from a situation that's almost unexplainable. I'm not someone who walks around telling people why the Holocaust happened. But I kind of understand why people want to figure it out. They want to learn because they believe God is involved in this world. They want to learn from something so painful, dramatic, changing the course of history, altering... I mean, everybody here has a story. Otherwise, it would have affected our lives too. And it certainly did our lives. They want to learn. And I think our sources tell us we're supposed to learn. And then what do we do with that information? How do I behave today because I believe God is involved in my world and because He's involved in the day-to-day lives that I have? And that's where I think Ramchal is teaching us. I'll read it for you in English. The human race is different from all other species since it was given free will, which we touched upon, and the ability to attain either perfection or deficiency. Those terms are good to know in Hebrew also. You see the third line, shlemut, which we're defining as perfection, or chisaron, or some sort of deficiency or lacking. Man is therefore a proactive moving influence. We're unique in that we are changing and modifying the world, ourselves and the world. The providence dealing with man must therefore also be different from that concerning others. In the case of man, providence must oversee and scrutinize every detail of his activities and produce consequences. It's kind of that interplay with free will. We have that freedom, and as a relationship to that freedom, there is consequences. Harva onesh. And our takeaway should be, we should learn from our messages, from our struggles, from our successes. I appreciate the help learning what to do with my stubbed toe, but to a certain degree, I think there's what to be learned from everything. Perhaps they'll say some people have greater divine supervision than others. Anybody here thinking that along those lines? Or does that break, this, mess up this whole construct? So how does that an extension of what we're saying? Does it follow, or is it running a counter to what we're saying? Are there some people, though, who are subject to greater scrutiny and greater supervision? We've already distinguished between other animals and other parts of the universe and humankind, because we have this free will, we have this charge to benefit, to be perfect, and then there's scrutiny because of that. Can there be a subcategory in that of certain people who are benefit or the beneficiaries of more? Yes.
So paying better attention to it.
Right. So I play this out with my kids. I've got my oldest who thinks he should be in charge. He should have no bedtime. He should have free rights with all the technology at the ripe age of 10. And yet at the same time, when the younger children who are adult treated differently, for example, I don't get as upset when they make a mistake occasionally, or I do perhaps allow them to watch Sesame Street one extra time while he has to do his homework. And he wants that type of treatment. So what's the argument? Why am I not giving him the childlike treatment?
He's not a child.
Yeah, he's not a child. He accomplishes more, he achieves more, and I can expect more of him. And I'll get upset when I see a mistake that a 10-year-old shouldn't make, but I won't get upset when I see a mistake of a 5-year-old or 4-year-old. I'm not sure I think that's what's happening here, though. I think if you're going to make that argument, it has to be as an outgrowth of what we're saying. Yes?
You would think that God would pay more attention to those people who have more influence over others because they can influence others to be good or bad, or to accomplish something that needs to be accomplished as opposed to not accomplishing anything.
Yes.
And so those people would have to come under greater scrutiny.
And I think that is an extension of what we've been seeing. That the more this relates to the God's goal and the realization of His will in this world, the more I think He's scrutinizing. And you think about in terms of, again, those athletes or my stubbed toe. But when you talk about somebody who is influential, who is praying on behalf, consulting, advising thousands of other leaders who are consulting and advising others, and this is having an impact on the people, the Jewish people, perhaps the entire world, it would be an outgrowth of this, is that influence and that degree of will that they can exert over people can be dealt with midah keneged midah, with more supervision. Mm-hmm. I hear you. Sometimes I have a hard time with it. the point was that tzaddikim who have more influence and are more capable are held to a higher standard. Did I paraphrase that correctly? Sometimes it doesn't sit well with me. Sometimes I want to believe that I'm Superman and that God, as much as I can do whatever I want to be, I want God to think that I can do whatever I want. Just like the guy on the bench who wants the coach to put him in because he thinks he can steal this game. And he wants the challenge and wants the scrutiny. And I'm not saying I need it right this second, but I'm saying that I feel like, I don't know if I always like that balance. But I think that, if you're going to say that some individuals are deserving of it, I think that's the way you have to go. It's as an outgrowth of the influence that they have and the ability to realize God's will that they possess. So here's where you get some of those sources. And again, you might see that what you're just calling a tzaddik could still be every one of you, depending. Look at the top one. What are we doing with time-wise? How much time do we have?
13 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So here you go. This is a very famous one. Make his will into your will. Asei ritzono kirtzonecha. In other words, make your decisions based on what you believe is God's will. Kidei sheyaseh ritzoncha kirtzono. So he'll make decisions based on what he believes is your will. Batel ritzoncha b'nei ritzono. Overlook your some of your desires and wants in this world. Because the mida keneged mida is kidei sheyivatel ritzonach erim et neiritzonach. Not his, by the way. It's interesting. But others vis-a-vis you. This is really the core of our major takeaway. That the mida keneged mida of divine providence puts you in the driver's seat. And so the question is, when you avoided that danger, obviously you have God to thank, but there's a mida keneged mida. There's that passage in the Talmud. What's off is Or Yisrael doing now? Their second parak? Isn't there that case where the dragon and the base medrash, seven-headed dragon? You know what I'm talking about? Not in the second parak. In the first parak? I think it's around Chaf Tester, the first parak. But when it's talking about fathers or children, who goes first in terms of learning? So there's a base medrash that had this supernatural being in it, and this fellow had come to town, and they couldn't get the supernatural being out of the synagogue, and they knew that in his merit he'd be able to overcome the being. So they told him to go daven there. It was empty. Just the thing was there. They told him to go daven there, and I think the Talmud records every time he bowed, another one of its heads fell off, and he was able to overcome it. The dragon part was more fascinating to me growing up, but the part that's more fascinating for us is he was upset. Why did you force me to use up merit that I perhaps have stored because of my accomplishment for your benefit? Maybe I didn't want to. And I wonder, because of our takeaway that you're in the driver's seat and that your relationship with God and the world perhaps is the biggest component of this whole thing, I wonder along the same lines. You're the same way that we're interpreting negative things, we should understand that the positive things that we do engender a good relationship and bring about good positive things. So did it come up yet again about Tarva Onesh? Was there Tarva Onesh already? In terms of how old, that this world is for doing and the next world is for experiencing a reward. So I think that has to be we have to deal with that source. You have to imagine that. But all I'm pointing out is that I wonder, and perhaps we'll ask our esteemed rabbis, I wonder if this model, it can't only be the negative, can it? That you get your content. So, yeah. So I think there has to be a component of that. If you look at these sources about the way that God's providence relates to people based on their actions, it seems not reward. Maybe we'll take reward off the table. But his providence, his involvement in your life. That's that term again of involvement. But his involvement in the day to day goings on of your life is enhanced, which I think is to your benefit ultimately, even though there is a degree of scrutiny because of it, but is enhanced based on here you have an example of awareness, but based on what you put into the system and how you behave. So I think that you can drive that up. And I definitely know I have students who don't want to drive up God's scrutiny in their life, but I think that that's overall to your benefit. The types of rabbis you see in the stories of the Talmud who experience that providence to their benefit, that a crumbling building wouldn't fall as long as they were in it, as a result of their relationship with God. And I think that's what we're driving towards. Leaving perhaps reward out of it. Let's just talk about God's supervision. I'd like to think that you can drive that up. All of you who are sitting during your free time, studying about the nature of God, looking at sources, taking copious notes, and debating it out, are raising your awareness of God. You're doing it tonight. And I can't say what's going to happen with traffic on the way home in terms of your supervision. but that's what we're talking about. And and multiply that over the series of courses that you're coming to and the commitment that you're showing to appreciate the essentials of Judaism, God's role in our lives, is what we're talking about. So you think you might have thinking, oh, yeah, tzaddikim who look a certain way and live in a certain town and only do certain things. But I'm looking at you. And each and every one of you walks away, with, I think, a greater degree. I don't know what the units of measurement are, but a greater degree. And more power to you. It should continue for many, many years. Well, so I would say like this. For the purposes of how that relates to free will, we need a whole other evening. Do we have another evening for free will? We had that one already. For the purposes, where I think your question relates to tonight is the victims of that evil. In the sense that if I'm walking around, I went to the essentials whole course, I'm very aware of God, I'm deserving of a great deal of supervision, I should survive when perhaps others don't. Because I merit in God's supervision. How God meets out His reward and punishment, which I think is another evening, perhaps, is a tough one. When I'm deserving of what I'm deserving, when I get it, if there is a hurricane and my house is destroyed and my neighbor's is not, which happened not long ago in the New York area. Well, we're going to talk about nature in a second. But in other words, it's negative things happening in this world. Who's the victim of it and who's not? And not everybody is walking around with a sign that says, I'm going to get it. So it's hard to know who's going to get it and who's not. Now, so again, how an evildoer has free will to exert to behave or to act out on that, kind of like Paro, kind of like other biblical and more recent modern historical figures, is a free will discussion, and I think it's because there is free will in this world. Who is the victim of that? In other words, I could be an evil dictator in my house and nobody knows. But who's, I mean, an empty house. In other words, you require victims to be an evil dictator. Who gets subsumed in that? And I'm not going to go near the Holocaust, but in big natural events where some people managed to survive, some very great people did not. That is a very tough discussion to have. And why they merited that, or why we as a people, as a world, and as God's creation, needed to experience that. I leave to the great. I leave to better than me in terms of really zeroing in on how that worked. But there is no question there's an interplay between evil, between free will and divine supervision. I do recall, though, that some very great people, I'm thinking in particular, did anybody read Hasidic Stories of the Holocaust? Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust by Yaffa Elias? You recall the way that the, who was it? The Blujever? The way that the Blujever Rebbe detailed his survival was right out of this shir, right out of it. This happened because that's the way he interpreted his life. And so you're going to ask me, what about the guy next to him, who was also a Hasidic Rebbe, who didn't merit that? I think there's too much of a reward and punishment part that I can't, not that I'm going to tell you either way, but that factors into who the victim of evil is. It's hard to say. I understand, but it's on all of our minds, and I think it's part of the same discussion. The last piece I want to share with you is a well-known Ramban. I think if it hasn't come up in this course, it's something for you to know and keep in your pocket and bounce around. And I want to preface it, is it 9:15 yet? 2 minutes. I want to preface the story of a very famous sculptor. This story is from Rav Asher Weiss, who lives in Eretz Yisrael. And he talks about a very famous sculptor who, along with the sculptures he was making for the public and by commission, he had a project that he was making in his private gallery. And it was a sculpture, the way the story goes, of a horse. And when he was done or in between jobs, he would come home and he would work on it late at night when everybody was asleep. And later in his career, he was finished. And he maintained it was his best work. And he thought, as opposed to everything else, which is in a museum or some private royal court, I'm going to donate this to my hometown. And they install it with a big ceremony in the town square. And he expects, with other things that he had made, he's going to get a lot of accolades. It's going to be a busy busy week for him, and nobody says boo. They all come, they have the cotton candy and the snow cones, and they go home. And he's upset. And so he turns to some of his close friends and he says, I don't understand. I've made sculptures that are world-renowned. People know who I am. People travel across the world to see my pieces. This is my best work. Nobody said anything. What did I do wrong? And they said to him, you made it too perfect. They didn't notice that it was a sculpture. There are other horses in the courtyard. Yours just look like theirs. So he said, what am I supposed to do? I'm pretty good. And they said, cut it in half and leave 2.5 feet in between the two sides. And when people see that it's broken open, they'll realize, oh my gosh, that's not a real horse. That's a sculpture. Wow, that's unbelievable. And he did it, and he got the accolades he deserved. What am I getting at? The Ramban's concept. The Ramban says that open miracles are designed to alert us to what we understand as hidden miracles. Many have said he kind of pretty much says it himself, that this is all of creation, all of nature, is divine will feeding through the channels of nature. And it looks so real and so normal, and we're so used to it that we take it sometimes for granted. I wake up and I can take a deep breath in. Or I woke up at all. That water flows, that gravity work. I'm reminded of all the Calvin and Hobbes where he wakes up one morning and gravity doesn't work. Those are some comments that I like a lot. But we're so used to it and it's real that we relate to this as normal, and then God and his providence will step in once in a while. And so then he goes and splits the sea, kind of like our horse. And you say, oh my gosh, he was making this work the whole time. And he called our attention to it because he made it stop. That's Ramban's concept of nature. The nature of nature, according to the Ramban, is that God has his hand and expresses itself through rules that he tends not to break. And much is why I said that's led some to believe those rules he lets go and govern our life the way he wants. We skewed a different direction and we felt that that was still directly God in our lives. And the Ramban wants to say that from the very first sentence, min ha-nisim ha-gedolam ha-mufursamim adam modeh, min ha-nisim ha-nistarim shehem yisod ha-Torah kula. You learn from the revealed ones to the hidden ones. And we also are perhaps familiar with the fact that the term nes itself, which is a miracle, the way we define it, shares its root with a sign, something of an indicator. And the Ramban clearly learns that we're supposed to take those as indicators of how our life is to be balanced. I feel like we could talk for hours and hours more, but we've touched the surface of these sources. But what I would hope, like I stated in the beginning, is that your takeaway from these studies is the impact it has on your life. We want to live meaningful lives. We want to do our very best at understanding God's will, becoming aware of his will and his role in the world, and translating that to how we lead each day. And I think the best part of divine providence is that each time we try to do that a little bit better, each class we go to, each deed that we do, each time we bend or sacrifice in honor of God's will, we are bringing him into our lives and inviting that very special care, that supervision. And when I think about it, I have my fourth child is the only one who goes to sleep each night like he already knows how. The rest of them, it's a negotiation every night. There's a thing called sleep. Your body shuts down. You rest. It works out really well. You wake up energized. It's like the first time they've ever heard of it. Number four gets it. Brushes his teeth, goes to bed. But every once in a while he says, can't you come with me and brush my teeth and tuck me in and lay down with me also? And, yeah, of course the answer is going to be yes. But the point is that supervision that he invites upon himself, the close connection is something that he wants and that he feels and he can't really go without. We as a people and as individuals, and I would say to this room as righteous individuals, merit that great supervision. And we, each time that we raise the bar, we invite it more into our lives. We experience it, and we're the beneficiaries of it. So thank you again for the chance to learn together. I'm so impressed and honored to be a part of this crowd, even for one night. And God willing, we'll continue to learn more and become more aware of God. Good night, everybody.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.